All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship. If you have not dealt with your sin nature, somebody stepped on your toes or whatever might have happened, you got out of fellowship. Now's the time to deal with that as you approach God's Word. Recognizing here that, again, this is spiritual information and as such requires spiritual wherewithal to ascertain what's being taught. So we saw in verse 1 setting up this analogy, this teaching with regard, and this is not just only applied to Babylon, this type of teaching is applied to Jerusalem as well when they were under discipline and ultimately would be conquered militarily. And that's the idea here, is of military defeat, but in this case, not just an incidental military defeat, but one that devastates the nation and leaves it without inhabitant. That's where, unfortunately, our nation is headed for a bunch of reasons, some of which we will be detailing in this as the pointed out there in the first session, that we are woefully unprepared militarily to deal with this. And my read on Vladimir Putin is he's the real deal. He'll push the button if he sees fit. And he's not afraid of anything or anybody. That's pretty apparent. And all those little Soviet empire that he's got over there under his thumb, those little breakaway republics, they're still under his thumb. Don't worry about it. When he flexes his muscle, they know it. They knew it in Georgia. They knew it in Chechnya. They knew it in the Ukraine. They knew it in the Crimea. They'll find out if they don't think he means business. So come down and sit in the dust. Again, these are imperatives issued that deal with the destruction of a nation, the virgin daughter of Babylon, referring, of course, prophetically to Babylon, our nation. Sit on the ground without a throne. Again, the life of a pampered, spoiled debutante who's had the best of everything, a princess, lives in her own little princess castle, and has all the best of things. For you will no longer, as it says here, be called tender and pampered. And speaking of pampered, I saw something this morning on the news. I mean, it's astonishing what you can see and what our nation is really like. I saw there's a new movement afoot that we should provide food stamps for dogs and cats. Now, that some people can't afford their animals and we need to give them food stamps so they can buy cat food and dog food. And so God help us. That's where we are. And that's the type of thing that goes on in Babylon, the land of confusion. Of course, that's what the thing means. Now, the verses that we've gotten the exegesis done in the in first session, take the millstones and grind meal. Remove your veil. Strip off the skirt, uncover the leg. The three, again, being reduced to menial labor is the first part of this verse. And the last loss of dignity and privacy and all of that deals with the next three imperatives. Remove your veil, strip off the skirt, uncover the leg. And really the idea of cross the rivers is ford the rivers. Now she's got to do all this by herself. Typically, princesses were carried about. They had portable thrones they carried them on. Your nakedness will be uncovered. Your shame, both of these words are references to the genital area, the one thing you're supposed to keep covered. That normal people have modesty, and because of that, this is a shame. And that's why one of the words used for it there is shame. I will take vengeance and not spare a man. And then you have a chorus that comes in here, our Redeemer. The Lord of the armies is his name, the Holy One of Israel. And again, we've gotten the exegesis of this finish, the exposition of these now, point one, following the commands in verse one, for Babylon to descend from her lofty position and sit in the dust. The Lord now issues commands that are commensurate with her reduced status. And again, the idea of a virgin is someone that has not been penetrated, someone that has not been conquered militarily. This is, while our nation has had battles fought on our soil, first, they're mostly in the distant past. While we may have lost battles occasionally, we never lost a war, and certainly not on our home front, not on our home soil. And so this is the idea of a nation that has adopted and lives a rather spoiled, pampered lifestyle. And again, we have to maintain a balance here, because this is obviously denigrated here because your average Babylonian doesn't give a thought for God or his plan. But the reality is God also provides us richly all things to enjoy. And so we don't have to feel ashamed of the fact that it's somewhat easier for us. But the fact that it is somewhat easier for us as living in a nation that makes things a lot easier in some ways makes us more culpable. The lack of doctrinal teaching, the lack of orientation, the lack of people or assembling for face-to-face, we have the wherewithal to do all this now. And that's the challenge, is in these last days to live out the Christian life in a nation that's largely opposed to it, as we know. Every divine institution essentially is under attack, from volition to marriage to the family to nationalism. All of these things are under attack. And the constant droning of the media in our ears. Again, very reminiscent of Orwell's 1984. Keep the populace lulled with constant announcements and news, and keep them on information overload so that they don't think about Big Brother and what he's actually doing. And we'll get into some of Big Brother's sort of nefarious schemes that have been going on. Some of them have become public, like through Snowden. But the fact is, there were people who had announced this before he did, that the government had been intercepting and spying on cell phones and emails and all of this for some time. That this goes back longer than what he was talking about. So here, instead of ordering others around, point two, as if they only lived to serve her, she is now ordered around as the lowest of the slave class. Three, the first order is to take the two stones. The Hebrew uses actually a dual form. I don't think I mentioned that in the exegesis here. But it's a masculine dual noun there of re kayin. So these are the two stones that comprise the handmill. To sit in the dirt and perform the tedious task of grinding the grain into meal or flour. And for it cannot be proven that grinding in itself was the kind of work that was despised, since like kneading and baking, it belonged to the common occupations of women. But this is given to a woman who's never done this. She's never had to do this at all. She's had everything handed to her as she lives in the palace. So, however, if there were slaves in the household, as there would be in a palace, no doubt, this menial task would be done by them and not by the mistress, and certainly not by the queen or the princess. She wouldn't be doing it. So one reason for this is that there was no special ability required for performing this task, so anybody could do it. Therefore, one would not assign this work to slaves with higher qualifications or greater skills. So this is the lowest of the slave work, even. But I mean, obviously slaves did a lot of different kinds of things, depending upon whether they were a domestic slave, whether they worked out in the fields or that sort of thing, or what they did. But in the household, this was the lowest of the tasks. So seven, those who labored at the millstones were considered the lowest strata of society. This is seen in the contrast between the Pharaoh and the maid behind the mill. That's in Exodus, as one compares that, Exodus 11, in the announcement of judgment on the Egyptians, Exodus 11:5. And all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstones. And that's designed to encompass their the lowest strata of society to the highest. Nobody was higher than Pharaoh in the land of Egypt. All the firstborn of the cattle as well. So eight, the mill was actually comprised of the lower stone, which had a peg fixed in the middle, and the upper stone, which had a hole drilled through its center. Drilled in its center, rather, through which the peg of the lower stone protruded. So nine, grain was poured into the hole while the upper stone was turned, and a groove from the center to the circumference of the lower wheel allowed the ground meal to work its way out from between the two stones. So grinding wasn't a fun job, obviously. It was tedious. And so, again, you only assigned this to the lowest of the low. So here the girl goes. Here the debutante goes from being the highest of the high to the lowest of the low. And this is commensurate with the nature of arrogance in humanity and how God deals with it. We've seen this first. We just referenced it in the Pharaoh of the Exodus, who manifested great arrogance against the God of Israel. And, of course, God knew he would, foreknowledge and all that. We saw that in Romans there. He was well aware of what Pharaoh would do. And he used this to evangelize the whole known world at that time. The Exodus out of Egypt, the news of that traveled far and wide. So much so that when Rahab the hooker ran into the spies, she said, we already know what's coming. We've seen what your God did. Word has reached us. And we're all living in abject fear. Because we know your God is not to be trifled with. And so we see the way he dealt with Pharaoh there, who was a negative unbeliever. The way he dealt with Nebuchadnezzar, who, as it turns out, was a positive unbeliever, who would ultimately believe, would accept the terms of God's plan. And see in Daniel 4 there, as he writes that tract out after his conversion. But God gave him a little, as he walked around in his arrogance. God gave him a wake-up call, a little seven-year disease where he thought he was a cow. And so he lived out like a cow. And so he dealt with him and humbled him. And that's one of the things, key elements in that tract, was God knows how to humble those that walk in pride. And the arrogance, again, here is seen in her speech and in her thinking. We saw that in verse 7. Yet you said, I will be a queen forever. These things you did not consider. And you felt secure in your wickedness, in verse 10. And you said, nobody sees me. And so this gives people, if they think they're not detected, people will take great liberties with your freedoms if they're not protected, and our freedoms. And that's been under attack again for quite some time, to dismantle the Constitution effectively. Again, this nation has not been at war since World War II, all the rhetoric aside. We aren't fighting any wars. There's no war on terror. It's made up. We not have and of course we give them nice names so it sounds good. Operation Enduring Freedom. Oh, it means we're going to decimate your land and your civilian population. Enduring freedom for who? It's not in Iraq, that's for certain. It's not in Afghanistan. Certainly wasn't in Vietnam, and now we're looking at Korea again. So there you go. So the mill again here now, Babylon, instead of enjoying the life of ease in point 10 here, to which she was accustomed, she will no longer be served by those who prepared and cooked food fit for a queen. Rather, point 11, Babylon will suffer the humiliation of doing menial, tedious, and tiring work of preparing food for others. And again, all of this is designed to communicate a military defeat that results in such a reduction of status that essentially this analogy, as all analogies do, breaks down. Because as we see here in the verses we're looking at now, in verse 3, I will not spare a person. The meanings, there are going to be no survivors of this. And again, the implication is, and the direct teaching is not even implied, it's directly stated, no one's going to inhabit the Western Hemisphere after this is all said and done. The only thing that will inhabit here are going to be desert creatures, hyenas, jackals, carnivores, the goats, as we saw, goats and sheep that are capable of living at high altitudes and can avoid some of the predators. Ostriches are mentioned. Again, there's some question about some of those words because they're very not very well attested. But there will be no human inhabitants. As we see, the prophecy given in Revelation 6, about 25% of the earth, about a quarter of the land mass of the earth, will be given over to warfare, death, pestilence, disease, and ultimately destruction. Again, we are the target, but unfortunately, if you live in Canada or Mexico or Central or South America, where any of our installations or military installations are, those are going to be targeted. And the reality is, again, this fits very well with what we're told, because with essentially the Western Hemisphere, the U.S., Canada, Mexico, Central and South America, comprises 28% of the land mass on the planet. And Revelation 6 says a quarter of it was given over to the fourth horse, the fourth of the four horsemen, death. So the next command, point 13 here, to remove the veil, has prompted a few explanations, which include protecting her skin from damage, shielding her beauty from the gaze of the common people, or simply as a command that reflects her new status as a slave. And 14, there is no question that the veil was used as a way of preserving the modesty of a woman, particularly women of significant status. They were almost always veiled. And 15, the most well-known use of the veil dates back to the Assyrians, whose legal code dictated that wives, daughters, and widows must wear a veil, but prostitutes and slave women were forbidden from it. And 16, thus the removing of the veil would symbolize her demotion to slavery and remove any idea that her beauty was too great for the common people to observe. 17, the next command to strip off the skirt is designed to portray further humiliation and the loss of the finery that had been part of her lavish lifestyle. Let's face it, if you live in a palace, you're going to dress the part. And certainly she did. There's no doubt about that. And so the Hebrew term here, shovel, skirt, is only used here, but deals with the train or the flowing long garments that were worn by the most privileged of women. This was not the common dress of your average person. The very term here indicates an expensive type of outfit. 19, this command naturally leads to the next one, to uncover the leg, which suggests a further blow to the modesty of one who has not known real suffering. And again, normal people, people who have any sense at all, who have any Bible doctrine, should know that modesty is the name of the game for women. This is taught all throughout the New Testament. It's taught in the Old Testament too, but certainly Paul makes it explicit, and Peter makes it explicit, that it's not the overt that you work on as a woman. It's the inner man. It's the new man. It's the inner, it's like gentle and quiet spirit of a Sarah's daughter, of one of her offspring, as mentioned in 1 Peter 3. And so there, and then also in 1 Timothy, Paul spells it out, also in Titus, that women are to dress modestly, that this is a part of the godliness code for them. And modesty means I don't see your underwear. I don't see your bra straps. I'm not interested in it. It's inappropriate. So tank tops for women, they're out. Don't come to Bible class with a tank top on, because it's not appropriate. And I've been tolerant and patient with all of this about people who sometimes don't dress the way they should. But look in the window, and if you can see any part of your underwear, you better get dressed. I shouldn't have to say this, but we do. And so that has to be addressed. And this woman here, this is a blow to the modesty. So 20, in ancient literature, respectable women are generally portrayed with long skirts. So uncovered legs were considered as inappropriate. Showing the thigh was something reserved for the poor, prisoners, dancing girls, or prostitutes. That's out of a work by James Pritchard, The Ancient Near East, an anthology of texts and pictures. So 21, some think these commands are simply given to prepare her for more hard labor in the field, while others suggest that all this refers to the disrobing and sexual humiliation of a captive slave. And to be, again, raped is analogous to being militarily defeated, and points to that. So 22, the final command of verse 2 is one that is vague, but most have concluded that it is a command for the virgin princess to travel without the benefit of a carriage or chair carried about by her slaves. And obviously part of this here, again, to cross the rivers, the veil has nothing to do with that, certainly. But obviously she would have to uncover the leg, i.e. hike up her dress, her skirt. You don't want to get your clothes wet when you're fording a river. And that's the idea behind this, across the rivers, to be reduced to the lowest of the low here. So a few have concluded that the previous commands regarding the veil, her flowing dresses, and revealing the legs served as a preparation for crossing the rivers. But obviously you didn't have to take your veil off to cross the river. Obviously I can see where you have to pull up your skirt and all of that, you know. You might remove your shoes depending upon what you're doing there. But however, it seems best to view this in terms of a forced relocation, which comes to Babylon in two distinct ways. The first is prior to the destruction. During that time, many of the inhabitants will willingly abandon the United States to return to the country of their national origin. Again, when you get into the chronology of Daniel's 70th week, we begin that. That's kicked off with the rapture of the church. As we let's see what happened here. Oh, there you go. Begins with the rapture of the church. We don't know when that is. And we're not to look. The Lord said, the hour of the day, nobody knows, no man, no angel. And if God hadn't revealed it to the angels, he's probably not going to tell you. Be nice to know. Like I said, I have wine and I have a schedule and I don't want to leave my good wine here. But I mean, that's selfish, I get it, but still. So those of you who are willing to help me. I'll have to call you. So we begin here with the rapture of the church. Church is taken out just prior. This is part of Christ's work to deliver us from the wrath to come, that we don't have to endure God's wrath. The promise given to the Philadelphia church there, Revelation 3:10, I will keep you from that hour of testing. And that term hour of testing, the term hour in the book of Revelation, is technical for Daniel's 70th week. The prophecy out of Daniel 9 there at the end of it. It's bounded on the other end. This is a 7-year period by the second advent, by the bodily return of Jesus Christ. And then you have 7 years in here. The technical, the midpoint, actually is the point, the kickoff point for what is technically in the Old Testament called the Day of the Lord. The Day of the Lord technically begins there, not at the rapture and not at the second advent. Because it's defined by two distinct things. A period of great and horrible destruction that results in man being reduced to almost nil. I will make mankind scarcer than pure gold. So if you can imagine a reduction of status in which this planet, right now with about 7 billion people on it, get reduced to, we don't know. I mean, is it a million that are left? What are the figures? We don't know. But he says, when I make man scarcer than pure gold, you got to know that it's small. That very few people are going to survive this entire 7-year period. And so the day of the Lord's kicked off. This is the vengeance part of it. And then the day of the Lord, of course, under the millennium, as you go into the millennium, that 1,000-year reign of Christ, we know the day of the Lord is about 1,003.5 years plus a little bit. Because it would seem to encompass the great white throne judgment as a part of that day. So here you got 3.5 years, though, and here you got 3.5 years. And again, we'll get into more of this as we get into the details, which will be obviously documentation for all of this. But it says that there's about 2 years in which this report goes out about Babylon's fall. And this is the report that goes out before the fact. And then it says in the third year it comes. So you got about only a 6-month period in here in which the destruction of America has to occur. So this does two things for the believer now living in the church age. Number one, we know we're not going to have to deal with this. But number two, we should certainly notify those if they ever express any interest in the truth, which most people don't. We know that. And we know the truth's in the minority. It's always going to be. But if they express any interest, this is information they might need. Because there's actually, when we get into Jeremiah, there's some commands for them to go out, some unnamed people to go out and spread this news about the fall of Babylon. So there's about a 6-month period here. And it looks to me, from all putting all together everything I've studied, Revelation, Daniel, the U.S., and all of this, is that this occurs probably during that first month, roughly. And I think it coincides with two things. The ejection and demotion of Satan and his demons from heaven, which occurs in Revelation 12. The destruction of the U.S. occurs then. And then, about that time, these demon locusts are released from Tartarus. And these are the angels who were incarcerated there because of the Genesis 6 episode. They came in and they cohabited, male angels. All males, all angels are male, by the way. They're not little baby cupids floating around up there. They're not cherubs in that sense. There are cherubs, but they're not like they paint them. And they're not female. All angels are masculine. And they violated the celibacy clause of their agreement. And they came in and had sex with human women. Well, this does two things. Number one, it creates, and any time you cross genetic boundaries like that, the offspring is always sterile. So this involved a race of angel men who could themselves not procreate. And the goal was to wipe out true humanity so that Messiah, the seed of the woman, could not show up. And that would, again, would have worked, except God intervened with judgment and stopped it. So those angels get out and they torment mankind for 5 months. And I believe that leads you right up to the beginning of the day of the Lord. So if you can imagine a world in which Satan's ejected from heaven, will there be visible Star Wars showing, depicting what's going on there? I don't know. But the Bible talks about signs in the heaven above and signs in the earth below. Blood, column, and vapor of smoke. A column of blood. And that refers again to the fallout from what we're going to get when this nation is destroyed in less than 1 hour of one day. And again, given what we're studying here, it's the things I keep seeing in the news just almost make me laugh. I mean, if it weren't so sad. But you watch these people in Hawaii, and they think they're under a nuclear strike, and they're running into their houses to get stuff. You don't have time for that. And I remember when we were kids, you know, the old drills, get in the hall, put your head between your legs. What they should have told us, was go ahead while you're there and kiss your rear end goodbye, because if a nuclear warhead strikes, you're not going to survive it if you're anywhere within the proximity of the blast zone. And then I saw they did a deal on one of the news deals about what would happen if a nuclear warhead, and they downplayed, if a nuclear warhead hit Los Angeles, yeah, it'd be bad for some, but not too bad. Well, what they have failed, well, and of course what they said was a 10 kiloton nuclear warhead, which is about 1/100th of the size of what the Soviets are using now. And they also woefully underestimated, because the Soviets have about 8,000 rockets that are capable, in many cases, of carrying multiple warheads. And so this idea, and again, they had a show years ago. I wish I could find it. I've looked and looked for it, but it's not available that I can tell. And it was when that show Nightline first came out, back in the 70s under the Ayatollah, when he took the hostages there, the Khomeini. And this came out during all that. And they showed basically what would happen if Russia ever decided to push the button. Because tensions were escalating back then, and certainly did to some extent under Reagan. But then this all, quote, now the bear has been declawed, we're all safe. The bear has not been declawed, people. And so the Russian bear, anyway, as all of this comes and happens, if you can imagine a world in which demons aren't let loose to torment the mankind, the United States is destroyed, and this is going to create havoc environmentally, physically, and in every other way. And it's going to actually change the rotation speed of the earth. That's the big passage when Jesus said, unless those days had been shortened, there would be no flesh saved. And I've watched interpreters for years stumble all over that, saying, well, then the second half of Daniel 70th week can't be 3.5 years. Yes, it is. It's just comprised of days that are only 16 hours long, though. As we saw in Revelation, there, chapter 8, when it starts talking about the trumpet judgments. The earth's rotation is speeding up is the only way you can account for this, because it says the sun won't shine for a third of the day, and likewise the night will be shortened by a third as well. And this idea of stars falling, and people are looking for a literal deal. If a star hit this planet, it wouldn't matter, it'd be vaporized. Our sun's a small to medium-sized star. And if you can imagine it impacting the earth, well, that would happen. No, these are not literal. But these stars falling symbolize Satan and his demons being ejected. And so these demons are turned loose to torment men for 5 months. The U.S. is destroyed. Satan and his demons are now loose on the planet, wreaking havoc as they can, as the will of God, the overruling will of God will let them. He obviously stops them at a certain level. But we also know that the protection of the Holy Spirit will be withdrawn in large measure following the rapture until he who restrains is taken out of the way. And that's technical for a reinstitution from the church age back into the age of Israel. The church age is essentially a parenthesis within the age of Israel. And now that parenthesis is over. Well, shortly it will be. Not right this second. So you got all this going on, and mankind is just going to, and they're going to be screaming bloody murder. We saw that in Revelation 18. The kings of the world are screaming bloody murder. The merchants of the world are screaming bloody murder. All those who make their living from the seas and transporting goods are screaming bloody murder. Why? Because no one buys their goods anymore. And the greatest importer of world goods in the last days is no doubt the United States. Without a doubt. Our trade deficit, the imbalance is astronomical. And ironically enough, even like I said, doing the study of all of this, finding out that we import more beef than we grow, that was shocking to me. Some of it I expected. We import olive oil and wine from France and, you know, teak and mahogany and all these expensive things, you know, Italian marble and all this. None of that shocked me. But to find out that we actually import more beef than we grow here was just shocking to me to see that. And it's been that way for a while. So again here, during this time, you got these 2 years here where they're given room and time to get out. And then as you go into that third year, you better have gotten out or else. And we're going to see this. Israel is commanded to set the tone for this. Israel is commanded to be like the ram at the head of the flock, i.e. lead the flock out. You better get the flock out of the United States before this happens. So they'll have opportunity. Now, will everybody avail themselves? No. No, because there's a huge population or some significant population that's left here that gets destroyed. So there's two ways in this forced relocation. The first is prior to the destruction. During that time, many of the inhabitants will willingly abandon the U.S. to return to their country of racial origin. So whatever that is, you know, if you're Italian, as it were, you'd head back to Italy. Russian, you'd head to Russia. Jewish, you'd head to Israel. And that's going to continue. And the second relocation comes as the remaining inhabitants are removed from the nation and sent to their deaths. And again, as I pointed out, I kind of forgot my story there, but they showed very well on Nightline that the Soviet strike, from the time the button is pushed, takes about 33 minutes to impact. It takes our government about 27 minutes to figure out if the attack is real or not. So, what will you do with your last 6 minutes? That's all you're going to have. And you know that panic will ensue. People will jump in their cars. They're going to try to get somewhere. This is worse than watching Irma come at you. This is something that you got nowhere to run. And as it says, all the leaders of the country are in the bunkers crying like women. So our military is not going to save us. That's what we've always relied on. But again, we've decimated our military, no doubt. Well, 25, one fact is very evident, and that is that Babylon is no longer in control of her own destiny. She no longer determines what she wants to do, since someone else, the Lord, is forcing this humiliation upon her. Again, the humiliation of the debutante is analogous to the destruction of the nation. And 26, nevertheless, it is clear that the captured slave girl motif is continued throughout this section. And verse 3 certainly advances this to the level of sexual humiliation. Generally speaking, what many people would consider the worst possible thing that could happen to a female, other than death, is sexual degradation. 27, the two verbs that are used here are both Hebrew imperfects, which denote incomplete action, but are normally translated by the English future tense. Your nakedness will be uncovered. Your shame also will be exposed. 28, since the imperfect can be used with jussive, that is, again, a second or third person imperative in the Hebrew. 4, some translate the verb as let your nakedness be uncovered. So some of the English translations will go with that. Again, that's just a judgment call. And it doesn't materially change what we've got here. Whether it's an imperfect in a command let your nakedness be uncovered, or a statement of fact, it's going to happen. Either way. So 29, the phrase to uncover the nakedness is found frequently in the Bible. And at the very minimum denotes the idea of humiliation, but includes all manner of illicit sexual activity. And in this case, it likely includes the concepts of humiliation and rape. Again, there's a lot of analogies used to this. Every analogy is imperfect and it breaks down, but the fact is they're great teaching aids. The slave girl, who's known nothing but the best of life, who lived in a virgin environment, is now reduced, or the princess, is reduced to a slave girl who has next to nothing and who is violated repeatedly. Again, teaching the concept of the destruction of the nation. So the next statement about Babylon's shame being exposed has been understood by some to be a euphemism that uses the word shame instead of the word genitals. Again, that comes from euphemy, and it means to speak well. And it's an idea of using a less offensive term to substitute for a more offensive term. So the Hebrew noun, kerpa, is derived from the verb karaf, which means to taunt, mock, defy, or revile. And the noun denotes the deep sense of shame or disgrace that comes upon one that is so treated. In 32, the idea of sexual humiliation or rape is a figurative way of denoting the shame and disgrace that comes on those that have suffered military defeat. 1 Samuel 17, 26. So, again, while these analogies break down, they're very effective at communicating this. It's a very graphic way of communicating this. Then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" And so the idea here is, and of course, this was Goliath calling him out to battle, challenging him, and taunting them. And for him to stand there and do that is a form of reproach. That he's essentially saying, our military can beat your military. And send me a guy out and we'll just fight it out one-on-one. Well, they sent a guy out. It didn't go quite the way Goliath had it pictured, as you know. Also, Nehemiah 1:3. Here, dealing with Jerusalem after its destruction militarily at the hands of the Babylonians. They said to me, "The remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach. And the wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are burned with fire." Again, it's defensive capabilities. This was, as we saw there in Isaiah 21. The command there suddenly in the midst, you got this deal of Babylon as it's going about its sort of daily life. And in verse 5 there of Isaiah 21, setting the table, spreading out the seating, eating, drinking. This is the Babylonian lifestyle. Again, we got whole things committed to this. We got how many cooking channels just on the TV? How many people spend their days worrying about nothing but food? If I hear that term, the foodie lifestyle, again, I'm going to vomit. This is what people spend their time and energy doing. And I'm not against recipes or good cooking or food or any of that. I like it. But it's become a lifestyle to these people. This is how they make their name. Nobody would know who Emeril Lagasse was if it wasn't for food. I mean, people get famous out of this, and for other things too. But then they say, "Rise up, captains, oil the shields," an indication that their defenses are not ready. Those are imperatives. The others are there, as I told you, were infinitives to express the sort of ongoing action of Babylon. Eating, drinking, eat, drink, and be merry. Because truly, tomorrow they may die. They won't tomorrow, but that's the analogy. So there it's used also Jeremiah 29:18. I will pursue them with sword, with famine, and with pestilence. And I will make them a terror to all the kingdoms of the earth, to be a curse and a horror and hissing, and a reproach among all the nations where I have driven them. Now this again gets to the Jews under captivity, as they're there in 70 AD when it was completely destroyed by the Romans. And the Jews went in to dispersion. But where they stayed largely until the repopulation of Israel began in the 20th century. And then also 49:13, same book. For I have sworn by myself, declares the Lord, that Bozrah, that's a part of Edom, will become an object of horror, a reproach, a ruin, and a curse. And all its cities will be perpetual ruins. And again, as I pointed out, we'll be doing, after we finish the Babylon stuff, prophetic Edom, which is another name for Babylon, which is another name for the U.S. Why the two different names? Babylon symbolizes our confusion, our doctrinal deviations, that we've thrown the truth out of our country, essentially. We've removed it, and we wonder why society's in the shape it's in. Why, when did Flavor Flav become a role model? Something's very, very wrong here. Something's very, very wrong. Why Edom? Edom is Esau. Esau was the one who traded away his birthright for a mess of soup. And that's exactly what our nation has done. We've traded away our Christian heritage for the liberal mindset, mentality. It's infected all of our seminaries, beginning with German rationalists back in the 19th century and early 20th, as that began to take over everything in terms of the scholarly aspects of the Bible. And again, much of that was just rationalism. It's not sound study of the scriptures, unfortunately. So Edom, we'll look at them as well. So 33, it is also used here in a figurative way to denote a nation that has engaged in political or economic prostitution with other nations. As we saw in Revelation 18:3, that's precisely what we have done. We've prostituted our nation. Our leadership. We personally haven't, hopefully. Hopefully we're not a part of this. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. And the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her. We've committed in these alliances and treaties and various things that we've done. As we've established kings, we set them up and then we tear them down. We did it in Turkey. We've sold them out. The history of the nations in the world we've sold out is lengthy. And we did it to the Shah in Iran. We knew Hussein didn't have weapons of mass destruction because we sold him everything he had. And we knew he didn't have them. So our CIA's been up to some really nasty tricks. Well, shall we mention Tuskegee? Shall we mention MK Ultra? Shall we mention some of their other funny, not so funny, their dirty tricks, the bag of tricks they play on people, on nations. And the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her prostitution, her sensuality. She has to live this luxurious lifestyle. Babylonians think they deserve it. Again, as I said, I saw that this morning. Food stamps for pets. You've got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me. People really think this is a deal? Oh, God. She's committed economic or political prostitution and is repaid by being degraded and raped, destroyed militarily. In the end, point 34, God will remove Babylon from her exalted position. She will be stripped of her luxuries, stripped of her dignity, and her private parts exposed to her cruel conquerors. All that analogy is designed to portray military defeat. And significant military defeat. We're not talking about losing a battle. We're talking about losing an entire nation. Who will debase her in the most degrading way. And again, this is all analogous to the removal of the United States from history, her loss of all her luxuries, and her nuclear rape. Again, if people think they can prepare for this, they're delusional. They have no sense of what a nuclear warhead will do. And as I detailed some of that in Revelation, those notes should still be on file. They may not be quite up to date. I don't know if we're that far yet in the proofing process. But the fact is, people have no, they're just not prepared for this. The scale of it is just astronomical, and there's no way to prepare for this now. And again, it would be great if I could find something in these prophecies that suggested they're conditional. There isn't. There isn't anything in any of this that says it's conditional. It's a done deal. It's always in terms of fallen, it's already done. In the mind of God, of course, it is. And again, why does the United States get this treatment? We are the last day's representation, the political side of the Babylonian evil that started at the Tower of Babel, continued throughout history in various forms, and now in the last days is manifested in this nation. And God destroys the whole system. Obviously, as we pointed out, when Jesus talked about that, he said, this generation, all these things are going to come on that particular generation. Only one generation in human history can get judged at a time. And so, this generation gets the brunt of it. For all of Babylon's activities throughout history, they're all sort of laid at our doorstep. And again, we've done enough to bring it on ourselves as well, too. Again, as it points out here, come out of her, my people, verse 4, because Revelation 18:5, her sins have piled up as high as heaven. Using the analogy of the ziggurat, the building, the bricks, each brick's an individual sin. We're building our tower to heaven, all right. But unfortunately, it's comprised of personal sins that God has to judge. The final portion of verse 3, again, makes it quite clear now that God is the agent behind this defeat, destruction, and degradation, that it's the Lord himself who will execute his righteous judgment on prophetic Babylon. And again, none of this fits. If you go back and try to fit this in with the Tower of Babel, it doesn't fit. You go in and try to fit it in with historical Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar when it had its zenith, or even under his son Belshazzar there, the last king. It doesn't fit. Because the prophetic Medes didn't destroy everybody. They just destroyed the leadership, and the city went on without missing a beat, hardly. And Cyrus was welcomed in Babylon as a conqueror. They did not destroy the populace. The city was kept intact for some time. So the concept of divine vengeance. And that's the end of there of verse 3. I will take vengeance. I will not spare a man. And that's clear that the author here is God, the speaker. So the concept of divine vengeance must be understood not as some outburst of anger or a desire to take revenge. Note the difference between the two words, vengeance and revenge. They're not the same word. God's not petty. This is all done because of righteousness and justice. This isn't God just losing his cool for a minute, as people do. I mean, we're familiar with that concept. Rather, it is rooted in the righteousness of God, who demands that sin and rebellion be punished at some point. Now, we know that he's dealt with personal sins on the cross. But unfortunately, for those who will not avail themselves of that reality by faith, they have to deal with God under their own righteousness. And people who think that their human righteousness is going to measure up to God's have sadly misunderstood the essence of God. Or ignored it or something. Because human righteousness is at best relative. Because we all sin. We all stumble in many ways. We all have an old sin nature. Romans 7 makes it plain. I know that in me, that is in my flesh, there dwells no good thing. And the sin nature is that functional and active part of everyday life. And that's not going to change. So God dealt with that. But again, if people don't avail themselves of God's provision in Christ, then they're going to have to deal with him in their own righteousness. And that's when they're judged there at the great white throne. All unbelievers will be judged by their works. Because they're relying on those to get them into heaven. And anybody that says that, you know, if you die, will you go to heaven? Yeah, why do you think so? Well, because I'm a good person. I keep the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. Blah, blah, blah. Inevitably, you'll hear them talk about their works. Why? But your works are not sufficient. Human works are not sufficient to gain salvation. Deuteronomy 32:41. If I sharpen my flashing sword, and if my hand takes hold on justice, I will render vengeance on my adversaries, and I will repay those who hate me. And now we know that God is patient. We know there in 2 Peter, as he even sets up the magical, as it were, I think not magical, but the time frame for human history, the 7,000 years, which is about up, 6,000 of them have gone by, roughly. The time of Satan's appeal is almost over. God did not grant him an unlimited appeal. And that he's got only a certain amount of time to prove his case. And he can't prove it because he's wrong. So, obviously, the appeal factor is still in play now. But that's about to be over with. Satan's appeal, again, any good judge will only let you appeal. Not our country, of course. You can appeal indefinitely, apparently. We won't kill you no matter how horrible you are. No matter who you've slaughtered. How many people. We'll put you on Prozac and put you in prison. And that'll fix you. No, I don't think so. It doesn't. And I will repay again. This is a problem. These people hate God. This is what your average cosmic person out there doesn't get. That they're not neutral in this like they think they are. I need to make a choice between God and the devil. No, if you don't make the choice for God, you're walking in darkness and you're under judgment. Jesus made that very plain. He who does not believe in me has been judged already. God hasn't executed it, but he's already judged. He's already condemned. And then judgment in that context has the idea of condemned. He is condemned already. So if people won't avail themselves of God's provision, they'll deal with God in their own righteousness. And good luck there. And again, everyone that appears at that great white throne trying to veil their case for their righteousness all end up in the lake of fire. Every one of them. So the modern understanding of vengeance, again, is often confused with the matter of revenge, which some insist is beneath the essence of God. Well, revenge is. Revenge is petty. Revenge is looking out for you, in a sense, and extracting your pound of flesh. But God's not so. The difference, point 39, between vengeance, the righteous execution of justice, and revenge is that the one taking revenge operates outside the law. He extracts his revenge in contradiction to the law, assuming that he is righteous and just in his action. And again, you can't, if your neighbor does something wrong to you, you're not free to kill him. I don't care what he does. You're still not free to kill him. You know, and I loved those movies probably as much as anybody when I was younger. You know, those, you remember those Charles Bronson movies and the Dirty Harry movies? I mean, at the end of it, you just love seeing them get what they deserved. But taking vengeance on your own is not vengeance, it's revenge. And that lowers it to a matter of sin. God can't sin. So he never just takes revenge on people, but he executes the justice that his righteousness demands. So, however, point 40, the Old Testament makes it plain that the entire purpose for vengeance is to uphold and restore the order of God's laws. See, chaos and disorder have come out of sin. Order and righteousness and all of that comes from the essence of God. God is an orderly God. He functions and he expects us to function in a decent and orderly fashion to reflect his glory. This is how he operates. God's not nonsensical. God doesn't do stupid things. Again, the entire purpose of vengeance is to uphold and restore God's laws, to provide divine justice for the victims of Babylon's abusive policies. And in our country now, unfortunately, sadly, the victim is often portrayed as the criminal. And the criminal has more rights than their victim. Not so with God. God keeps track of all of this over the years. And all the things we've done, all the double dirty dealing that we've done, all the sneaky backroom deals that this country's done as leadership and the people in power, all this blending of the, essentially blending the military, industrial, and political and economic complex together so that we're going into nations and setting them up for call centers for Nike or Nike plants. And again, we've documented some of that in Revelation 18, as they call them the walking ghosts who work in the Nike factory. And the type of conditions. We've now begun to use the prison system as a means of free slave labor. And again, I'm not against the prison system, but you're not going to rehabilitate. I love that movie Shawshank. Rehabilitation, that's a made-up word, sonny. For people like you who sit here behind a desk and you think you know so much. Rehabilitation? You're not rehabilitating criminals. They get out, and again, the recidivism rate, if you go in once, you're going to be at, odds are greater than 50% they'll commit another crime and end up back in prison. After the second one, odds go up to like 80 or 85%. And the recidivism is huge in this. And we use slave labor in other countries too, by the way. People who have not been denied due process and are in these foreign prisons. There's choice, you know, I think, buy them for $1 a day and use them for their purposes. So the blending of all these things is going to get us into trouble. It has. And that's where a lot of these abusive policies and actions have come from. Pursuit of the almighty dollar. The bottom line is profit. As long as the stock market's moving up, Americans are happy. As long as the 401ks are okay, I don't care what you do. Is essentially the attitude of many people. Okay, well, our time, whoops, our little bass gone, so we'll stop there and continue on here Tuesday evening. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to consider these matters. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our spiritual growth and future glory, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.